Hi, and welcome to Filmmakers Compass Podcast, the show where we talk about movies and, well, more movies. I'm D-Man, joined by CP. CP, how are you doing today?
Dude, what's up with your voice?
Well, actually, I went to Disneyland the last weekend, and I feel like I have lost my voice, so it might be a little higher than usual and a little raspy. But no, I am not sick, no sore throat, I feel fine.
Just from screaming on all the rides.
Yeah, I did get
like
on
Jungle
all the rides.
Cruise.
I'm not going to lie. I literally arrived at Disneyland at 7:30 in the morning, and I was at the park from 8 a.m. until 12:30 at night. So I was there all damn day.
Wow.
But it was totally worth it. It was so much fun. And I actually got to go with Tyler and Christina, who we had given a shout out a couple weeks ago. And before we get into our shout outs, I did want to say, Tyler, thank you for reminding me to send you the link to our show, which CP, I forgot to do. Somebody wanted to listen and I forgot to send
the
link.
Dude, are you like the worst co-host ever? You're actively working against the success of this podcast.
I know. I was like, how could I forget? So thank you for reminding me and thank you guys for tuning in and listening. So, but yeah, I don't know if you've been to Disneyland, but hopefully you have been to the movies.
I have been to the movies.
What'd you see? Dune again?
I saw Dune. I saw Arthur the King.
How's that?
Saw Ordinary Angels. It's Mark Wahlberg, dude. Come on. It's also a dog movie, and I love dog movies because I love dogs.
We should do a list sometime of dog movies.
We should. Air Bud's probably at the top. Just calling it right now.
Yeah, we'll add that to our list of topics for future episodes. But for all you dog lovers out there, we'll announce it ahead of time so you can tune in. Nice. Well, yeah, it's always fun to get to the movies. I actually am excited to go. I want to see the new Ghostbusters movie, so I'm looking forward to that. And hopefully it delivers because I actually enjoyed Afterlife. And CP, I'm in the minority here. I know I said this in our movie remake time, but I actually did like the Ghostbusters with the women. So
answer the call. Not a
yes.
Fan. Not a
no,
fan.
I mean, it's not as good as the original, but like I did love the humor in it and I found it fun.
Real question is this. Are you getting the specialty AMC popcorn container?
The trap?
Yeah.
Ooh, I hope so. I wanted to get the Dune popcorn bucket, but they were all sold out at the AMC I went to. So I know it was popular and this one might be as well. These are pretty cool. I actually really like what they're doing with these kind of collectible items that you can get going to the theater. You know, not just collectible items that you can get out and about. Because I think for a long time, you know, they still do this. I got one with Dune where they give like the paper poster. But I don't know that anybody like 10 years from now wants that paper poster. But they will want the Ghostbusters trap that they can eat popcorn out of.
No, I agree, dude.
You know, I got one for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles last year. It's literally like a trash can. And then they just fill it up with popcorn, and then they have an actual lid for it. And then it's just got decorative TMNT stuff on it.
That's so cool.
Inside and outside.
Oh, that's
which
even
is
awesomer.
I know. So I'm a big fan of this because I think those things will indeed be collectible. There will be people that are huge TMNT fans. They're going to want that. And even there might just be movie fans that are going to want all the different movie.
Well, and what's cool about it is, again, it's a reason to go to the theater because that's the only place you can get it.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, I don't know why they're running out. I'm not sure if it needs to be that collectible. Like, I went on premiere night and they didn't have it. So I was like, well, I mean, you should at least have it on the first night.
Yeah, right.
I don't know what was going on with AMC. But anyway, those things are pretty cool. And I hope that if it's available, I will indeed get it. So, and maybe I'll display it somewhere here. Check it out, CP. Maybe I'll put it up here.
Nice. I think you should. Oh, sweet.
For all of our listeners.
Get that R2 unit?
Oh, at Disney.
It's not technically it's awesome. R2. It's just an Master Tech droid.
Well, I did name him R2-D4, which the numbers refer to Kobe Bryant, even though he is red, black, and white, which are not Laker colors. Figured, what the hell? He's a nice call sign. Shout out to my wife, Steph. Well, CP, let's go ahead and jump into some shout outs before we get into our topics this week. And first up is none other than Ivor. Ivor, we actually need to catch up with you. So we have on the last few episodes included some of your shout outs, but you have many more. And so this week we are actually going to dive into a couple of those. So he said about Maestro, makeup deserves a mention, but like CP, I felt that it is nothing but Bradley trying for an Oscar run. So fair. I think we all kind of felt that way where, you know, unless you're going like full breakdown of what this character's life and work signifies, biopics often can just be Oscar vehicles. Probably was. The opposite being Oppenheimer, where there's a lot to think about and a lot at play in that film. And it's not just a movie about his life, but American history and lots of different elements. I love that comment. He also said the first three Lethal Weapons and first three Alien movies come to mind for top movie trilogy series. I like the isolation and mood of Alien 3. So honestly, Ivor, we might have to have an Alien marathon because Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3 are all very different.
And they're all by three of the best directors ever.
Yeah, like they're
Ridley Scott, they all James have Cameron, their, David Fincher.
Yeah, they all have like their own sort of style and mood. Even though it's like the same visual aesthetic, they're all distinct. Really good mention right there. I haven't watched Alien 3. I think it's CP. It might be all the way back to us as roommates in college.
Probably. It's been a while for me too.
Yeah, it's been a sec. I have watched Alien and Aliens though, both of those, which are awesome. You know, I think that sort of thriller sci-fi mood of the first one. And then like the full on like action take that everybody sort of, it's like wish fulfillment. Like, oh man, imagine if you could actually like just load up on the most cool guns and then like go try to take this thing down. You're like, there you go.
Right.
Yeah. Lethal Weapon. I love the first one, all the movies. I mean, what comes to mind when I hear Lethal Weapon is Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And them like making new sequels like three times. I'm too old for this shit, you know? but yeah, I mean, those are great too. So he goes on to say, I know this is pithy. I had a problem about Kimmel's monologue at the Academy Awards. He said something about, even though there was a shutdown in Hollywood, that they still produce many great films. I think most of the films represented at the Oscars were finished, and that statement should be used at next year's awards. Are you following me there? And yeah, actually, I agree with that as well. Yeah. Like for instance, Barbie, Oppenheimer, they didn't get their promotional run, but they were pretty much done by the time the strikes went into effect. So there were a few movies, I don't know the release dates of all the nominees, that did come out after. But again, I think to his point is that a majority of production was done. I think what we lost out on was mostly promotion.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily that these movies were wholly impacted and their trajectories changed due to the strikes.
Good call, Ivor. That's a good point.
Yeah, I like that. Oh, and then he says, also, I think the Naked Gun trilogy should be mentioned. I don't know. I guess you could. I don't know. We're talking best trilogies of all time. I mean, it is a trilogy. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that one, CP?
I heard they're remaking it with Liam Neeson.
What?
Which seems bizarre. So bizarre.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what was his name?
Strike me as a funny guy.
What was the actor's name? It's
Leslie
Nielsen.
Nielsen.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, he's just so perfect in that role. Like those movies are cool and everything. I mean, I wouldn't stack it up against like the Star Wars and Lord of the Rings trilogies, but pretty good. So CP, I do have a couple more shout outs. So Boone actually chimed in and was watching the Oscars live. So I wanted to give him a shout out and say thank you for sort of live commentary on the Oscars. And he had predicted a few things wrong. And then we actually got one wrong, which we thought Across the Spider-Verse would win for best animated movie. But it actually makes sense. I mean, it was kind of the crowning achievement of, you know, essentially Japan's like greatest anime creator. So
that's true.
I didn't mind it. I thought it was pretty good, but Boone did bring up a good point on something that we missed last week on the podcast. And that is Al Pacino announcing Best Picture. We did not talk about that on the show. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this. What did you think about how he did that? I didn't know if he was drunk or
It was like the
old.
With the exception of the year where they actually called the wrong movie, it was like the most botched delivery of the Best Picture winner ever.
Well, first of all, he did not like recap the nominees. So if you watch the telecast, they basically between each award, mm-hmm. they had featured one of the movies for probably about less than a minute, maybe a minute mm-hmm. at most. And then they were sort of, that's how they were doing the nominees throughout the night. And they've done this in various ways. They've had actual presenters come out and talk about the film or whatever. Like, this isn't new to the Oscars, but what was weird was that when he came out to announce the best picture, he didn't recap it, or like they didn't put all the nominees up and sort of like do a quick rundown, you know, even if it was just posters or poster art or something. He just came out, like said a few things, and then he's like, how did he say it? He's like, my eyes. My eyes see Oppenheimer. And everybody was like, yeah, that's what your eyes see.
Is that the actual winners? The other thing was, like, normally people walk out to announce and they look very together, and like, no offense, Al Pacino, but he looked almost exactly like in Heat after he gets in that fight with his wife and he steals his TV.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, did they just like roll this guy? Like, was he just sitting on his couch? And I'm like, whoa, dude, you got to get to the Oscars now. And just like Uber blacked him right down to the theater. And he just like walked up on stage, 'cause he did not look prepared in any way. He did not look together.
Yeah, no. And I mean, in Al Pacino's defense, I don't know if you've seen him on red carpets in the last few years, but not great. He actually cut his hair and like apparently was trying, but you know, still not good enough. But yeah, like when he actually announced it and he's like, my eyes see Oppenheimer, like that's all he said. And so everybody was like, wait, what? And then the music played, I think, and everybody was like, it's Oppenheimer. But
it was bad.
I don't know. It was just a weird, weird thing. So thank you, Boone, for bringing that up, because that was definitely something.
How did we not talk about that last episode?
Well, we talked about it in pre-production, and I think it just slipped our mind. I actually have it here. I have it listed in my notes. I have like Billie Eilish, I'm Just Ken, John Cena, Arnold and Danny DeVito, Batman, Al Pacino, Donald Trump. Like, it's in there. I think we got carried away with some of the other topics. So thank you. I do want to give a shout out to Abraham Torres. I woke up the other day to him quoting Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. He just texted me out of the blue. Good and I love getting movie quotes out of the blue. And he was actually quoting when the Riders of Rohan show up on that hill. And I was able to complete the quote where I'm like, ride now. You know,
yeah, that was awesome. Yeah. Oh, that's a good one.
Totally made my morning. Thank you, Abraham. Appreciate that. CP, you went and saw Madam Web, which I believe we did mention last week, correct?
Yeah, I think so, unfortunately.
Well, according to your posts, Brian Ten Bosch chimed in and said, throw it in the trash.
I wasn't really sure. It. Was he talking about the movie or was he talking about my life? Because it was a pretty bad choice.
I think he was talking about the movie. But on that note, I just wanted to say, hopefully it's in the trash. So I don't know if Brian saw it. I didn't see it. So I don't know if it was that bad.
I hope nobody sees it. I wish that on no one ever.
I'll take your word for it. So final shout outs. I want to give a big happy birthday shout out to Johnny Sanchez. It was his 65th birthday this weekend. I hope you had a fantastic birthday. And then a belated birthday wish to David Gutierrez, who also listens to the show. And David, hope you had a great birthday.
Happy birthday.
So, all right. Well, CP, let's go ahead and jump into our topic this week. I'm going to let you introduce it.
Actually, let's take a second to talk about some box office numbers. This is our box office breakdown, where we are going to let you know what's new in the world of box office. I don't know why D-Man hates talking about the box office so much. I find it fascinating. So
I love this discussion.
The interesting thing is this, as I'm sure you guessed, there weren't any real major changes in the box office. Last weekend, Kung Fu Panda retained the number one spot. Dune Part 2 retained the number two spot. And the brand new Mark Wahlberg movie, which I saw, Arthur the King, jumped into the number three spot with about $7.5 million domestically.
Now, okay.
The interesting thing is when we look at the global worldwide box office, Dune Part 2 is still going strong with close to $500 million made worldwide. And Kung Fu Panda is in second place with $177 million. So
that's pretty far off.
I'm assuming all this stuff is going to change, though, when Ghostbusters comes out this upcoming weekend. But, you know, I think the real question is this. Is it possible that Dune 2 is going to break $1 billion? And with the way things are going, no.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Probably end a solid $700 million.
A billion's tough. I mean, they've already had their biggest press, the most they're going to get in terms of a wave of interest in the film. And that got them halfway there. I mean, It seems unlikely that they'll make up the other half. If they were at like 750, 800, at this point, I might agree with you. I think the only things working against Dune are, one, it is a very long film, which does affect theater runtimes, as well as people's
willingness to,
you know,
see
appetite. Yeah, appetite for sitting through a 3.5 hour movie or however long it is. And then, you know, as a sci-fi epic, I know Dune is considered, you know, one of the more popular sci-fi novels of all time, but it does feel a little bit more niche, where I feel like Lord of the Rings in particular was more mainstream. Even if you'd never read Lord of the Rings, you were sort of familiar with it, where Dune, I feel like there's a lot of people who probably never heard of it, even despite having a movie made in the 80s. They've just never heard of it, you know, up until part one. So there's probably a lack of interest from some people that would otherwise probably really love the movie. They just don't know.
So no, I think you're absolutely right. So that's your box office numbers, D-Man. Now let's actually get into this episode, as I know you're anxious.
Yes. Let's hear it. So CP, I know you're going. I'm going to try to go, but I can't guarantee I'll make it. But this week is actually the re-release for the 25th anniversary of The Matrix. So yep. If I'm not mistaken, it's 1999. And at that time, you know, it was the Wachowskis, but now the Wachowski sisters. And it's just an incredible movie. We've actually talked about it on this podcast before. So we're not going to do a full breakdown per se of what we love about The Matrix and all this stuff. But I want to throw it over to you first. You know, why do you think the original holds up after 25 years? What about it has staying power?
Wow, that's a very deep question. I think part of it is The Matrix was groundbreaking from a visual effects, right? There was a lot of sequences and its use of physical stunts with emerging CG technology. It really pushed cinema in a new direction. So that always helps. But on top of it, they did a great job of taking a very high concept story and packaging it in a way where I think the average moviegoer, for the most part, could understand what was going on.
Yeah, they do a few things in the movie to emphasize that fact. You know, one, I think the most obvious is it adheres pretty strictly to the traditional hero's journey.
Exactly.
Which is just a familiar storytelling vehicle. You know, Star Wars, A New Hope adheres literally almost beat for beat. In fact, you know, in film school and writing classes, I think Star Wars and probably even The Matrix are taught when discussing the hero's journey as modern variations of that. And so using that as sort of the spine of the story, I think helped take this high concept kind of world and everything that they're creating and grounded it in a story that's very familiar.
Exactly.
So I think that worked. I think you had mentioned in pre-production, if you want to explain it, they have a sequence where they do boil essentially another high concept thing down into a visual, which is great because it embodies show, don't tell, which I think other lesser movies tend to just tell us through monologues or, you know, long exposition, where here they were able to very clearly articulate this through a visual.
Well, and I mean, when you think of The Matrix, one of the most infamous scenes in the movie is the battery sequence where Morpheus holds up the Duracell battery to show us that this is what human beings are in the future.
What and product placement by Duracell? That's just awesome.
Comes off so well because he's explaining these high concepts of this Matrix world. But as soon as he shows us that, it doesn't matter. We're like, boom, I understand. Thank you. I get where we are. We're batteries.
Yeah, like he literally is explaining sort of the history. And at this point, they're visually kind of showing us exactly what he's talking about. But this is a little more tell, don't show, right? Like it's mm-hmm. him telling Neo specifically, like, how did we get here, right? You know, because mm-hmm. at this point, Neo's perception of reality is only the Matrix. He doesn't realize yep. there's another world outside the Matrix. And so he goes through all of those layers of AI and they took over and all this stuff. But he's able to very clearly just be like, you know what? The whole point of all of this was that the robots are turning humans into this. Mm-hmm. And then he just holds up that battery and you're like, okay, that makes perfect sense. They're using, you know, human beings as batteries to power their robot technology. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And without that sequence, I think the movie would have been much more, you know, convoluted to everybody. But because they brought it back in that simplified visual image, everybody got it.
I also think one of the things they do really well that allows the movie to hold up is the genres that they're playing in, which are sci-fi and kung fu, which I think it was neat that they reintroduced sort of that kung fu martial arts genre in a fun, creative way for modern audiences at the time in 1999, because kung fu or martial arts films, you know, they'd kind of fallen to the wayside for, you know, 80s big gun action, you know, A-Team or
yeah,
like Arnold and Stallone and all of this. And there were these, you know, epic sci-fi movies, Terminator, but it was with guns most of the time. They're not doing this sort of hand-to-hand combat. I mean, at that time in 99, the closest you're probably getting to that is like Dragon Ball Z on TV. Mm-hmm. You know, at that time, the greatest action cartoon ever made, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So we just weren't seeing a lot of that. It reminded me a little bit of like Westerns. In American cinema, Westerns at one time were a premier genre of American cinema that have sort of fallen off. Right? We don't get a lot of Westerns anymore, you know, and usually when they're dated. They take place in a previous time, you know, occasionally like Star Wars came out. It's including a little bit of that genre in it. And I think that touches something with, you know, movie going audiences, and Kung Fu here does that same thing where it just sort of works and it grounds the film and makes the fighting and action easy to understand.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the Wachowskis, in their decision to make a sci-fi kung fu movie, right, which, as you said, they very famously pitched this film to Warner Brothers as Kung Fu meets robots, which is a great description. Awesome. Because we get
that's
that.
Sold.
But as you said, they take high concept stuff, the most high concept sci-fi film we maybe have ever seen. At the same time, they intersplice it with these intense, visually satisfying, intricate action sequences. And because of that, they just really hit this formula where if they leaned too far in one direction or the other, I just don't think the movie would be as remembered as it is.
Right. And even, you know, Kung Fu itself, it doesn't date anything in terms of the actual technology that was being used, you know, where you're like, you know, look at them with their guns. And, you know, we're so evolved at this point, you know, Kung Fu plays great 25 years later. It plays just as well today as it did 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So, and on that note, I think another reason that the movie actually holds up is the in-world technology. We haven't surpassed it in 25 years. So we do have, you know, MMORPGs, we do have virtual worlds, and we have virtual reality. We've talked on this podcast about the Apple Vision Pro and sort of, you know, the Quest headsets 2, 3 and where this is all heading. But I mean, we're clearly nowhere near Matrix level technology. And CP, we've also talked extensively about AI and its role in the movie industry. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like artificial general intelligence and this whole thing, like we just have not reached that point of where the Matrix is at in the future. So I think in terms of does the movie hold up? It does, because it's still a warning for those same exact things.
Yep. Yep.
So even probably more prescient today than it was in 99. No, like at in 99, that was like true sci-fi, where today we're like, we're pretty damn close to this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, we better watch out. You know, we might have to black out the skies, go underground. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a, I mean, that's a good point. That's a good point. And so, on that same note, right, the portions of the world taking place in the Matrix, while they are dated, they are intentionally dated to the Matrix, which was created to mimic the year 1999. So yeah, even from that perspective, it doesn't feel like an old movie.
Yeah.
Because it's intentionally set at that point in the past.
Yeah, and if you didn't know any better, right, you're just plugged into the Matrix as a battery, then that is your present. That's your reality.
Yeah.
You know? Yep. So, and who knows? You know, if the Matrix had lived on, maybe they would have updated it, you know, every 5 years or so. Introduced some new tech for those zombies in the Matrix.
Right.
You know, I did want to give a tip of the cap to, at the time, you mentioned bullet time and some of the special effects. I mean, the Matrix was known for being groundbreaking. I don't know if you've ever seen the behind the scenes on bullet time, but they actually set up cameras to represent, I believe, frames as they would run the camera. Instead of physically moving the camera, they would snap individual photos.
Yep.
And they would then, I don't know what you'd call it, like edit it all together or like stitch it all together. And yeah, you would get the visual of like the camera sort of floating around Neo, but it was like real. That's insane. Not this virtual thing. Like, they set up these cameras and did that effect. It's pretty wild.
No, it's awesome.
I think of, you know, in the 90s, the movie Speed comes to mind, where it was like this huge phenomenon. And everybody was like, oh, Speed is so good. And then it's like, the, you know, people made copycat movies, and it's like, it's Speed on a boat, which I guess was just Speed too. But, you know, it's Speed on a plane. It's Speed at a resort, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that happened in the 80s with Die Hard. And with The Matrix, you saw a lot of movies sort of take these visual effects and implement them into their movies. You know, I think there were just things as like Jet Li films, Bulletproof Monk, and, you know,
yeah,
all these different movies of that era where it felt like, you know, oh, it's like the Matrix effects.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's pretty cool, because they do have their place then as, you know, a special effects movie. And I think the Matrix acted as, you know, maybe an inspiration for a lot of current special effects artists. Oh, I
definitely agree. So
you might see that showing up in other works, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then something else that I think the movie does really well, and I always harp on this when we do our total rewinds and movie remake time segments, and that is, I think the film has a strong iconography. It embeds itself in our culture, whether it's the falling green code that many people had as their own computer screensaver, mm-hmm. bullet time and special effects. The movie is quotable. I think the music to this day is still recognizable, especially that main entrance theme. Mm. You know, if you've ever seen the movie, you remember it. And then I'll throw it over to you. Like, one of the best scenes, it stands out so well, is Red Pill versus Blue Pill. And if that's not an analogy used all the time mm-hmm. for people having to make a choice,
yep,
you know, that's a great scene. And again, like we had said earlier with the battery, like their ability to sort of condense all of this down into like this choice.
Yeah, that's very visual. I don't know if I'd use the term
iconography.
Iconography. I don't know that that's what I would go with. I think it's just the style of the Matrix in some ways has outlived the story itself. The cyberpunk look with the sunglasses and the leather, the green tint and the blue tint of the movie. I think that those type of things have made the movie memorable in ways that if it was just set like any other action movie, I don't know that it would be.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the right word is, but that's what I use. CP, I mean, we've both watched this movie recently. It's just awesome. It's so well done. It's a complete self-contained story. I mean, my assumption is that at the time, they did not know if they would ever get to make sequels or if they'd even thought about sequels at that point. You know, so much as like, it's just this great film and I really enjoy it.
Because when we look at the story arc of Neo, it's almost completed by the end of the first film when he becomes the one and he realizes his control over the Matrix and he's become the master of it. And it's wrapped up rather nicely.
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, it just has that rewatch quality that, you know, allows a movie to last for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you had mentioned too, something about Plato's The Cave and how this movie is sort of like, is it like remake of that? Yeah. Or is it an analogy or what's going on?
Allegory. I think that, and I mean, one of the other reasons I think why people have so much fun still talking about The Matrix is there's lots of different analogies and themes that people see explored through the film. I think Plato's The Cave is a great one in the sense that if you remember the story from philosophy class, right? Socrates is telling the story about these fictional prisoners who've been imprisoned their entire life and they've never seen light. They can only see the shadows of the firelight. That's what they understand the world to be. And once that prisoner, one of the prisoners is released, he's scared of it. And when he goes out into the new world, he sees this new reality that he never could envision while he was trapped in the cave. And upon returning to it, you know, the rest of the prisoners in the cave don't believe him. And actually, since he can no longer see in the cave, think that the outside world is actually harmful to them. Obviously, that's a very short description of a very big concept, but you can see elements of that at work in what's done with The Matrix.
Yeah.
Neo is this man living this everyday life in this world that he thinks we live in until Morpheus shows him the truth. And he is exposed to this whole other world that he didn't even know. And I'm not going to lie, really sucks. And I would rather just live in The Matrix, especially if it's set in 1999.
Oh, yeah, I'd go back just for the music. Yeah, no, I mean, the movie, it just does so many things, right? I think, you know, it was perfectly cast. You know, everybody played their, even Cypher, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, who is that? Joe Pantoliano?
Yeah.
Well, how do you say his name?
Pantoliano or something.
Yeah, Pantoliano. I mean, he does a great job. You know, we can all kind of see it coming, but that makes it a little bit more fun because you're sort of on edge with his character waiting. You know, mm-hmm. It's not the surprise. It's like, hey, when's it going to happen? And it adds a certain level of tension to the whole overall story. And yeah, I just thought everybody sort of brought their A game. I mean, for the three main actors, Carrie Ann Moss,
Lawrence
Fishburne and Keanu Reeves. I mean, this was like a career defining role.
Yep.
You know, Absolutely. This was definitely, you know, one of the movies that meant, you know, many people will know them for. And so I think that's another reason that it holds up because, you know, you still see these actors in different movies, particularly Keanu in John Wick, but which again might be what modern moviegoers will remember him for is John Wick. Mm-hmm. But there is, you know, an entire segment of people that will remember him for Neo.
Yeah. Oh, I definitely
Mr.
agree.
Mr. Anderson. What was his name? Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
Just like the most bland. Sorry, all the Thomas Andersons out there. Just like basic name. So, and then the final thing, CP, that I wanted to just sort of, before we move on, acknowledge is sort of how, you know, The Matrix through a trans lens can have sort of a modern day interpretation where I think because the actual directors have transitioned and are now the Wachowski sisters, there is a certain level of reading of their work as maybe, you know, The Matrix is representative of like being in the closet and then being freed and, you know, like sort of knowing the truth. There's identity at play. I think one of the things that comes up often is, right, Neo's insistence on being called Neo and not, you know, they keep referring to him as Mr. Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of like misgendering or misnaming somebody after they've transitioned, like a lot of things. There is a certain reading of the films through that lens that I think has a modern day relevancy.
Mm-hmm.
That is maybe even more true today than it was in 1999.
Yeah,
just because
again,
how
like,
things have progressed there.
Exactly. And I think at 1999, we're seeing this story about, you know, perceived reality versus actual reality and truth and the subject nature of it. And I think after looking back 25 years and seeing the transformation that the both directors went through, I think it's very easy for people to say, well, were they trying to tell us more? Was there this whole other set of themes that we didn't know about until now that, you know, 25 years later, we're on the other side of this? And I think it's definitely a possibility.
Right. And, you know, maybe to their credit, I've never seen any interviews or heard anything where they directly address this. But it seems like as the sort of authors of the story and the directors of the movie that, yeah, people sort of read into, like, obviously there's probably some elements of this at play, mm-hmm. just, you know, from within their own lived experience.
Yeah.
So, but again, that's a reading of it. That's an interpretation of it. And you can see The Matrix in many different ways. So, but I just think that maintains its relevancy today and why we still celebrate it after 25 years.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I wanted to move on to a slightly different topic, but we're still talking The Matrix here. And I wanted to ask you, why in the world do you think the sequels are nowhere near as beloved? Now, we've heard this saying many times, you know, the sequels are never as good as the original. And there's a few exceptions to that where people can argue, right? Dune Part 2 is, you know, probably the most recent version of that.
Yeah.
But I would say Dune Part 2 is even like, it's a part two. It's not even like a sequel in maybe the traditional sense, although it is objectively, I think it's better than Part 1. But you have Empire and Godfather Part 2, and there's a few out there where people are like, oh yeah. But most franchises, you know, as the sequels progress, they get worse.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's the case here, but we can definitely acknowledge that we won't really get into the new Matrix sequel. We're just going to talk about the trilogy, the two sequels. They're nowhere near as beloved. I mean, they might sort of be required viewing if you're a fan just because you love that world and you got to see it through. But I don't think people hold those in the same regard as the original.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, why do you think that is? Like, what happened here where they literally have such a rich world, they have beloved characters, they have many of the elements that should equate to, you know, if not necessarily as good as the original, but right there, like, what happened?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to story structure. There's a lot going on in these films, but let's look at story structure first. The first thing is the hero's journey as it portrays to Neo is kind of concluded to a point where you would wrap the story at the end of one.
Okay.
And it's never continued to the effect that it should be if that's the narrative that they're interested in following.
Okay. I mean, a great analogy is just Star Wars: A New Hope, right? Luke, at the end of the first movie is, spoiler alert, he uses the Force to help the rebels defeat the Empire and destroy the Death Star, but he's by no means a Jedi. In fact, in the part two, Yoda says that he's probably too old to be trained and all this stuff, which we know obviously goes out the window. In essence, his arc is complete when he's able to defeat his father and stand up to the Emperor and declare himself a Jedi. But that arc takes three movies. Mm-hmm. Right. It doesn't end at, he's not a Jedi at the end of the first one. In fact, we've never even seen him in a lightsaber duel.
Right. And so
there's still a lot to be. Yeah.
And if the first Matrix ended with Neo having this undiscovered potential that maybe we see glimpses into, and then the rest of the trilogy is a quest for him to explore that and reach his full potential, then we have a very complete Neo-centric story.
Yeah.
Now,
I agree.
The other problem is that aside from the hero's journey structure issue, I actually don't think the trilogy is structured like a trilogy. There's a first movie,
mm-hmm.
then there's the first part of the conclusion and the second part of the conclusion. We're kind of missing that second block in the chain.
It's Reloaded and Revolutions, right?
Yeah. Because
so what you're saying is almost like how Dune is like part one, part two, but it's one. It's almost like Reloaded and Revolution are its own thing. And then the original Matrix is kind of like separate.
Well, Reloaded is like the first part of Revolution's storyline, but But honestly, you could cut Reloaded down to like a half hour movie and we could get the gist of what we need from it. So the arc is not balanced in a way that we expect a trilogy to be balanced.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
let's
see that.
Let's look at the movie Revolution or Reloaded as it is. I mean, there's some incredible action sequences.
Yeah.
Like incredible action sequences, but they don't actually, they're like very Michael Bay inspired. Like they don't actually drive the story. They don't affect the decisions that the characters make. They're not based around characterization like the action sequences in the first Matrix are. They're just there and they're fun to watch, but they don't contribute anything meaningful.
Yeah, I think you do make a good point in that, you know, those action sequences, it almost felt like because of the recognition the first movie got for its special effects and bullet time and all of that, that they felt compelled to like, well, we have to like up the ante and we have to create. But in doing that, they created the sequences, but like you said, they weren't integral. You could probably cut them and get that runtime down to that 30 minutes you said, where you're like, it doesn't really matter. Like you don't need to see anything. It's just cool. And that's always, you know, a recipe for disaster.
Well, and then, I mean, even the villains in it, the twins, like are so B tier in terms of the actual Matrix storyline. Like they don't really contribute a lot.
I mean, we can give a tip of the cap to Monica Bellucci. I mean, that's all. We'll leave it there.
It's look, there's stuff that's fun, but it just doesn't carry the weight that the first movie does. And I think that same thing follows through Revolutions. And my problem with Revolution is the story just doesn't hold up. I think if this is the story about Neo, even if we say at the end of the first Matrix, Neo has achieved this status, now is about him continuing forward, right? Well, based on that trajectory, Matrix Reloaded should be a movie where Neo proves to the machine that he is in fact the master of the Matrix, not them. And the best example of this being a failure on the part of the writers is when Neo fights Agent Smith, right? In the first one, he beats Agent Smith very, very easily at the end. In the second one, they just kind of, they have that awesome fight sequence where they fight sort of perpetually until realizing they are matched completely until Neo just runs away. And Reloaded should have been a movie about Neo as a character, proving to the machines that he is the master of the Matrix. And then the last bit of growth for Neo is he has to become, if he truly wants to save humanity, he has to leave the Matrix in 3 and destroy the machines outside of it, which they kind of get to in Revolution, but he also doesn't actually ever truly destroy the machines and free humanity as he is set up to be as the savior messiah figure.
Yeah, that's, I think there's a lot of things in there too that you mentioned that also, like, first of all, like, where, how did Mr. Smith even come back? You know, I don't know if it's ever really explained. I mean, they sort of discuss him as this like negative part of an equation. I mean, I'm sure with deeper reading into it and all that, you know, you could figure out exactly what they were going for, but it just felt like when you're watching it, like, I guess he's back, you know? Oh, okay. And he's stronger, but why, you know, where did this power come from? Because in the first Matrix, we were taught that the machines were limited by the technology and algorithms that humans could exceed, right? Or the one could exceed. But I mean, even the humans in the Matrix can break the rules. Or I think he says bend the rules. And then the one can break them.
Yeah.
But like, where did he come from? You know, it's not really explained. He just comes back. It's like they needed an adversary for Neo that could be his equal. But like, realistically, like you said, in the story that they'd written in the first one and created, like, Neo should have no equal.
Well, and on
he
top of
be able to bend, you know, or break the rules and do whatever he wants.
I mean, and the other problem is, right, like, who is the villain in the Matrix trilogy? It's not the architect, you know.
It's, I mean,
not,
it's Mr. Smith.
It is. It's supposed to be Smith. But the problem is Smith is set up as a subordinate program within the Matrix, right?
Yeah.
But he's not executed in the way that he should be to rise to the level of the Matrix's grand villain. The character of Smith should have been a better example as someone like the character of Javert in the story, Lemiz, right? This character who lives by a code of black and white, and he sees the world in black and white. For Javert, it's right and wrong. For Smith, it should be, this is my job. These are the things that I do policing the Matrix. And it when it reaches the point that he realizes that not even the AI overlords who oversee the Matrix that he is responsible for running are abiding by those same rules, he takes it upon himself to rise to a level greater than them to put things back in order.
Oh, dude, we should have got that movie.
But we don't get it. We get like this guy who just, because he's a cool villain in the first one, just keeps coming back to a stronger and stronger level to the point that the humans and the machines are like, oh, at the end of the day, like, we all just hate Agent Smith. So if you do something about that, Neo, like, your people can do your thing. Us machines will do our thing. And like, we'll just call it, you know, evens.
Yeah, I think that would have been cool. I think Agent Smith evolving too and having sort of a different appearance, because he always takes on the appearance of an agent. But he, if like you said, if it's done correctly, he should be superseding that. Mm-hmm. He's not an agent anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But he always sort of has that appearance, which again, just sort of reinforces visually that he's still bound by those same things where he should look different.
Yep.
You know, I don't know. Another thing that I think pops up frequently is that the story itself in Reloaded and Revolution got too convoluted, too philosophical, a little hard to follow and understand, where we talked about the first movie was able to sort of simplify these concepts visually and convey them in a way that was digestible. People were like, okay, I mean, I don't get everything that's going on here, but narratively, I know exactly what you're talking about. Neo's got to make a choice, or humans are batteries. Well, you're like, okay.
I think about, and I think the best example of this is when Neo finally goes to talk to the architect in Reloaded.
Yeah.
They just have this long esoteric conversation with big words, big words, big words. And I'm like, you guys got to pop out a visual now so we can see it.
Yeah. It just gets a little too deep. And I think, you know, this is a good example of what happens in movies. Maybe like Tenet is a recent movie where
it's a good example.
You know, I think it was a little too confusing. Even though I know there's a YouTube rabbit hole you can go down and you can go figure out or, you know, decipher exactly what Christopher Nolan was doing in that film. But it was a movie that, you know, for most people, just upon an initial viewing, they didn't really know what exactly how the mechanics of the world worked and what was happening on screen. And to the movie's detriment, right? It was a little hard to follow and understand. And I'm a good example of that, me personally, where I remember like after Interstellar, you know, which I'm just using another Nolan movie, but after like Interstellar, I'm like, oh my God, I want to know more about time dilation. And I went down that YouTube rabbit hole because I thought the concepts and stuff in the movie were fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to learn more. But after Tenet, I was like, you know, I don't really care to learn more. Like,
yeah,
you know, like everybody that was telling me, they were like, oh my gosh, like the movie's so amazing. And like, you have to sort of learn how all this stuff works. And I was like, you know, I don't know. And that's not to say that I won't watch Tenet again. I mean, I'll definitely give it a shot. I love Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
But movies can have that effect where you sort of lose people along the way, even though you're doing these really high concept things that, if given the time and exploration, probably are as deep as they appear to be. It's just that most people aren't willing to put in that time.
No, I agree.
So, you know, another one is Star Wars prequel trilogy, right? Like the first trilogy follows the hero's journey. You're watching Star Wars. It's this big space opera adventure. And then you go to like the prequel trilogy and George Lucas is getting into politics and like, you know, democracy dies. And, you know, this is how democracy dies and like all this stuff. And you're like, I didn't know we were getting into like Senate seats and right? Thought this was Star Wars, you know,
right.
It's a little bit high concept for, I think what people's perception of it was that it's going to be like adventure and fun. And even though I love the prequels and, you know, that's like I said at the top, like I don't hate the Matrix trilogies or, well, I hate the last one. I thought that one was only, you know, as a trilogy, it still works. It's just, you got to be sort of willing to deeper.
And again, I also think it's weird that at the end of The Matrix, like, the machines are not defeated. I think we want a story where the one saves humanity from their AI overlords.
Well, right. It's just a piece. you know, and peace doesn't always last. So yeah. Is that the end, or, you know, and especially like you said, given robots' lack of humanity, I don't think it would come off as, because the movie or the trilogy itself never posits that like robots are living beings and they should be respected. Like, it never takes that stance.
No,
ever.
In fact, one of the things that we do see in the character of Neo, what sets him apart is his love for Trinity, right? That's what set him apart from all the other ones in previous Matrixes, and that's what sets him apart from the machines.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, yeah, again, they broker this peace, but first of all, like, can you even trust robots to maintain a peace? No. I don't know. Can you even trust people?
No.
So, I mean, it seems very fragile at best. And at worst, you're like, I mean, the war will just start up again. And so it doesn't seem like peace is the best option. Where I understand having, like, you know, a third option sort of as a narrative element of surprise, right? Like, Luke Skywalker needs to defeat Darth Vader to become a Jedi, but instead he refuses to kill his own father and, you know, tosses away his weapon and sort of chooses that third option. If you do it right, it can work.
Yeah. No, I agree.
It's just, they didn't really execute it in a way that peace makes sense.
No, I totally agree.
So I do want to point out also that in the third movie, Revolution, I think they stray too far away from the main characters.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. And I think that might even be a whole failure of the trilogy, in the sense that in the first Matrix movie, we are introduced to a cast of characters, right? Everyone on the Nebuchadnezzar. And then most of them are kind of wiped away. And in the second film in the trilogy, we get a whole bunch of new characters, and that continues to grow in the third. But the problem is, those aren't people we were invested in from the very beginning. And I think that's a problem.
We feel that. It just doesn't, you're kind of like, I mean, I know we're following them, but I don't care about them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, can we get back to Neo? Because that's who I wanted to see, you know. And they have these incredible sequences of people and, you know, mecha droids and firing guns and all this stuff. But even some of that, to an extent, loses, I think, a little bit of its like epic scale when, you know, it is all CGI and it's characters that we don't really care all that much about. I mean, no offense, but like, yes, the main characters in the Matrix are on a quest to save Zion and humanity, but to be honest, we don't give a shit about anyone in Zion.
No, in fact,
like,
they're
narratively,
they're kind of douchebags too. Like, literally, they're talking about how like millions of machines are at the door of Zion, and they're all just like in a drug-induced rave partying the night before. And I'm like, do you guys really want to live? Because that is like the
opposite. Well, maybe not. Like, that's the thing. Like, if you don't want to live, like, maybe that's the way to go out. So I'll keep that in mind for the future, because we're pretty close. Drug-induced rave, got it. But yeah, I think they stray a little far from the main characters. And part of that, you know, is, and again, you know, there are character deaths and things that happen, but like, you know, even Morpheus is relegated sort of to, you know, gunner on a ship. And then,
we're
just following these other people. And I just don't think it works narratively. Like, you want to follow the characters you love, that you fell in love with initially.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that drags it down. And then, you know, I think too, like, there are some religious overtones and they don't feel proper to me. They feel a little shoehorned in, because I never got that sort of religious vibe from the original, even though, like, there's, you know, the prophecy and the Messiah, the one, and all this stuff. Like, those elements are at play. And, you know, again, like, another movie where we see that now is Dune, where, you know, there's a cautionary tale about buying into all of that crap. Here you have it. And we sort of talked about this a little bit, like Chosen One storylines last week, or no, 2 weeks ago when we talked about Dune. I don't know. I just don't know if the religious aspect really elevates the story in any way other than us just making connections if you happen to know the religious story.
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. In all honesty, I think the other thing that I find really odd about The Matrix is, I get the idea of having a final showdown outside of The Matrix. But I thought it was really weird how they try to take the powers that Neo and Agent Smith, you know, possess within the Matrix into the real world. I thought that was just
weird.
Too weird and kind of a stretch and sort of a disservice.
Well, it also didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I obviously there's a metaphor there about like Neo losing his sight and, you know, sort of finding it again through an essence of code, the way he sees it in the Matrix. But there's nothing within the story that suggests that should happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it just feels a little like, I guess that's lucky. You lost your eyes and yet you can see, like, I don't know why, but okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then obviously like Agent Smith sort of taking over a person's body and like checking out of the Matrix. I don't hate that concept. I just think it would need to be executed a little bit better. I just think it sort of came out of the blue, where if you had done it correctly, it could have been cool. And I don't think I would have him, you know, I like the idea of him trying to kill Neo in the real world. I think that actually makes a lot of sense if he's able to escape the Matrix into a real world body.
Yeah.
I think it might have worked better if he was sort of operating from the outside, maybe getting information or different things for a majority of that time and not given the opportunity to interact with Neo directly. It might have added more tension to the story. I just didn't get what they were going for.
No, I thought it was weird.
So I also wanted to address, the Matrix is a story that after the first one had a lot of people theorizing. We heard a lot about a Matrix within a Matrix. You know, is the real world really the real world? And they also neglected to address that at all, even though that was what, you know, I mean, we kind of got that movie later with like Inception, a dream within a dream.
Yeah.
Like layers, but, and you know, Christopher Nolan is actually playing with that idea, right? At the end when he spins the top and does it fall. Kind of like, I mean, what is the real world? What is it?
Yeah.
And the Matrix had a chance to maybe explore that theme even deeper than Inception does, because you had a trilogy to do it, and they declined. They did not go that route. And I think maybe for a lot of people, that also was a letdown of expectations. I think they were thinking it might go there, and it just doesn't go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a really good point.
I don't know. Sometimes that's some, you know, just a mismatch of what you're expecting versus what you get.
Yeah.
Can, you know, change your perception of those movies. But yeah, overall, I mean, I think sequels do have trouble living up to their, you know, original works. And when you see it done right, it's so special. And I think that's why, you know, on this show, and if you go, you know, basically on anywhere on social media or YouTube, you're going to see most people cheering on Dune Part 2.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
And it's because it's so rare. We just, you know, you get Jurassic Park, then you get The Lost World, then you get Jurassic Park 3, you know, or you get The Godfather 3, or, you know, even while we've said many times on this show, like, I applaud George Lucas's effort to tell a different story. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody's like, oh, the prequels were better than the original trilogy. Even though
Ivor.
I
think Ivor told me that once.
He likes the prequels more?
No, I just wanted to troll him on this.
Oh, I was like, Ivor, let's have a discussion. But no, I mean, like, it's just such a hard thing to do, to live up to an original work, especially a beloved work. You know, it just happens more often than not that people fail at it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, 25 years, CP. That's pretty impressive.
Well, if I can swing it, it's not playing in any of the theaters near me, because it's obviously a really limited release. So if I can make it, I will.
Maybe I need to rewatch the whole trilogy. I'll see if I can make it to the theater, go watch the original, and then watch the other two.
I've seen the new one.
I don't even count it. I
hate the new one. That was bad. I think,
I mean, it's fun in its own way, but like, as far, it's just not even relate, like not even remotely the same story.
Well, and it's just dumb. I'm like, okay, so you have to rebuild the Matrix, and I get that you're like, oh, we need Neo and Trinity to make this thing balance. I'm like, okay, I can kind of buy that. Then why the heck are you bringing back Agent Smith? Apparently, yeah, if he was such an a-hole that even the AIs hated him, I'm like, why do you need to bring that guy back?
It really doesn't make sense.
It honestly feels like a cash grab.
Well, that, and it felt like a commentary on sequels and
yeah.
Like,
yeah,
there was a little bit of that at play, which that's what I was talking about. Like, it can be fun in its own sort of unique little space that it has. But in terms of, like, as part of the Matrix anthology, I mean, it's god awful. It just does not fit with the original three. So, but anyway, CP, that actually, that does it for our discussion today, unless you have anything else you'd like to add.
Only thing I would like to say is I would have loved it if in the trilogy they finished off exploring that cave analogy. And at the end, yeah, after Neo freed everybody, if he was, even though he was the savior, he was rejected because they couldn't believe the world that he was describing to them. I think that would have been really cool.
Yeah, I always hate when we're like, oh my gosh, this is what they should have done. You know, that's literally what my episode on The Last Jedi was a few weeks ago. Like, what should Disney have done with, like, the sequel trilogy? And it's like, at times I'm like, oh my gosh, like, it's not even that difficult. Like, it seems fairly obvious in retrospect, but who knows, you know, what the vision was at the time. So hard to say, but I do applaud when people at least have a vision and they're trying to do something. Just because it doesn't always work doesn't mean it's not worthy of, you know, checking out. And I think the Matrix trilogy is that. It's definitely something that if you get a chance, check it out. And you can dig deeper, whether it's going down that rabbit hole on YouTube, going and checking out some blog posts, or even listening to, you know, some of the old DVD commentary and what they were up to, because they were trying to do something. And I think that's incredibly admirable. And I think when you get storytellers that can do that, that's just awesome.
That's what makes movies great. The story.
Yeah. Well, CP, to all of our listeners, thank you all so much for tuning in. I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Be sure to continue the conversations on social media and our website, which you can go to at filmmakerscompass.com. And you can follow all of our social media channels at Film Comp Podcast. And you can follow me at Big Kid D-Man.
And you can follow me at NDCal5. Thanks for hanging out, talking movies with us. We will see you back here next week. Until then, keep watching movies.